Let's move on to another category then. Next generation rock and metal, I've called this category. Because, you know, metal is beginning to fractalize, or heavy rock is really beginning to fractalize off into all sorts of different subgenres. You know, there are so many subgenres of metal these days. It's almost impossible to keep track of all of the different ones there are. And it's beginning of it, I think, around this time. Because we have, I'll just rattle off the five that we've got in the list here. And this is by no means a complete list of all the metal albums released this year. But in a way, each of these five records represent a different aspect of how heavy rock and metal has fractalized in this particular time. Hysteria, Def Leppard, the big American arena rock sound. Big production, big harmonies. Scum by Napalm Death, the first Napalm Death album, which kind of kickstarts the whole notion of grindcore music. Appetite for Destruction by Guns N' Roses, which is almost a return to the old-fashioned rock and roll approach to heavy rock, but definitely with a very new 80s kind of sheen to it. The old-fashioned rock star in a way. Electric by The Cult, which is a Rick Rubin produced, very stripped back, almost a pastiche of AC/DC in a way, but with a very up-to-date 80s production. And then the last one I've got on the list is Under the Sign of a Black Mark by Bathory, which is seen as very much a precursor to the whole black metal scene. That came out of Scandinavia at the time, Bathory being a Swedish band. This was their third album. It was very influential on the whole black metal genre to come. So there you got five very, very different albums that all notionally are under this broad umbrella of heavy rock, heavy metal. But until now, heavy rock and heavy metal, you haven't had this incredible range. Everything sounded like basically a descendant of Black Sabbath or Led Zeppelin or a combination of the two or Deep Purple. And suddenly, I mean, you could argue that Napalm Death, Scum, it's got as much to do with experimental avant-garde noise music as it has to do with heavy rock and metal. Similarly with the Bathory record. Whereas Guns N' Roses seems like a very traditional kind of idea of what a heavy rock band should be. I mean, they were a phenomenon. This album still, I think, is in the top 50. Appetite for Destruction after all these years, you know. Any of these bands appeal to you at all, Tim?
No.
Okay.
Obviously, I've heard probably all of them on and off in some ways. It's just not my music, really. But I totally accept that. I think that 87 was a really healthy and fertile year for rock and heavy rock. And you can argue that bands like The Mission kind of touch on it. As I was saying, I think that the influence of Led Zeppelin was writ large this year. I mean, I've got a lot of time for Led Zeppelin, but Led Zeppelin is so much more than a hard rock band. You know, it's folk, it's progressive, it's experimental, it's roots, it's all sorts of things. Plus, they are just such an amazing organic machine live. And it's flexible. They've got the flexibility of a jazz band. Like a lot of those great, I suppose, you know, the trio's Cream. And then also when you're getting into Peter Green's Fleetwood Mac, they've almost got the flexibility of great jazz bands. The rock bands are like early Black Sabbath. People forget, you know, you listen to Paranoid, you listen to Black Sabbath, the album. They were always experimental. But they're a really quite loose band.
Okay, there is one band on this list that you can say that with the Guns N' Roses. Guns N' Roses. But this is a record that's got Welcome to the Jungle and Sweet Child of Mine on it. Well, you know, both very traditionally classic
both
rock.
Yeah, still absolute classics.
Yeah. And they use synthesizer on some tracks. I know because I remixed this album into Atmos. Okay. Never going to come out, unfortunately. There's a lot going on. It's very aware of a lot of different things, all perhaps things from the previous decade.
Yeah.
But still, there is a lot going on in the music, and it is quite eclectic and it is quite diverse.
I think they never really, you know, I can see they're good. Obviously those two tracks are enduring. You know, they're still taught in guitar schools all over the world.
I think the whole record is a classic. It's one of those records where every track seems like it could have been a massive, massive single, massive song.
For me, I suppose I guess they're in my Rolling Stones category, although there are some Stones albums and tracks I really quite like. It just, there's a certain kind of showboating quality.
It's very showboat. It's traditional rock star. It's posturing.
That doesn't appeal to me.
There's a lot of posturing.
That's where I'm lost, but I can totally see why people love them and why they're lauded.
They ticked all the boxes for very quickly becoming one of, I mean, they literally with this album almost overnight actually, that's not fair. It took a while for the album to really, you know, catch fire. But once it did, they pretty much overnight became part of that rock royalty hierarchy in a way that very few bands have pulled off over the years. I think their masterpiece, personally, is Usual Illusion, the next record, which was a two double albums released on the same day. Just amazingly experimental in terms of being a rock and roll band, amazingly experimental, amazingly diverse. But Appetite for Destruction is a great pop record at the end of the day. Every song is a great song. Every song is memorable. You can imagine any of these songs becoming staples on rock radio. And in fact, that's pretty much what did happen.
And Hysteria as well.
And Hysteria too. Yes, that's true. Yes. In a way that you can't say about Scum by Napalm Death. The one thing I love about Scum, the whole thing about Scum is kind of like the birth of what we now call grindcore music. Scum has the infamous track You Suffer on it, which lasts for 1 second, which was released on a double A-side single, I think, with another song by a band, I think it's Electro Hippies or Anal Cunt, which also lasts for 1 second. So it's a double A-side with 2 1-second songs on it. What could be more performance art than that?
That is almost throbbing gristle.
Exactly. Let's move on to... Well, this is just something I think we mentioned in passing. This is a category you've come up with, Tim. The Summer of Love Returned.
Oh, yeah.
There's a little bit of a resurgence in psychedelia this year, isn't there? In fact, we mentioned this when we talked about Butthole Surfers. There's definitely an influence of psychedelia. Mm. But there is actually things that are even more wearing that influence on their sleeves. Obviously, now we have the second Dukes of Stratosphere album, Sonic Sunspot, from this year, which, if those of you don't know, was XTC pretending to be a lost 60s psychedelic band. But there were also bands that were doing it in a much less tongue-in-cheek way. Spaceman 3, completely besotted by the idea of, well, not only psychedelic music, there's a lot of Velvet Underground in them as well. It's a bit more, but definitely taking on board that kind of whole drug rock thing. And also the Bevis Frond, In a Marshland. Was that the first album of Bevis Frond this year?
Honestly, don't know. I was never that familiar with them. But I think this kind of adoration of the Summer of Love was coming back. There was a sense of 60s imagery, 60s sounds. It was funny because although it was the 10th summer, you know, seemingly since punk, in some ways, the Summer of Love was slightly more celebrated in 87. There was more a sense of incense and long hair rather than...
Is it perhaps a yearning back, you know, things have come around, so there's kind of a yearning. Kids are growing up hearing these great records from the 60s and 70s, so thinking to themselves, why isn't music like this now, you know, and forming bands that kind of mine that era.
It's an attractive era, and, you know, you find it in all sorts of times, because obviously... Even the late 70s, early 80s, to a certain extent, the Liverpool scene, we've said this before, that the Liverpool post-punk bands, in some ways, seemed as influenced by early Floyd and early Doors.
And the Seeds, 13th floor elevators,
There was always that quality coming up through underground music. I don't think it had ever gone, but it sort of rose to the surface more as the decade wore on.
Well, indeed. And right at the end of the decade, we have the Manchester, the explosion of Manchester. Bands like Stone Roses, Happy Mondays, In Spiral Carpets, Charlatans, very clearly indebted to that kind of psychedelic music, Summer of Love. But actually... Certainly in the case of Happy Mondays anyway, twisting it into something a little bit more contemporary, a little bit more, a bit fresher, also absorbing DJ culture and dance culture and electronic music to create this new era of psychedelia. And interesting, because our next category is indeed Manchester. Some very important Manchester records. The first Happy Mondays record was this year.
Yeah.
They've yet to find their sound, I guess, but it's the debut album of Happy Mondays. The most important record to me, well, the two important records to me came out of Manchester this year. The final Smiths album, which I think is my favourite Smiths album. There's something, certainly in the musical forces employed, there's something much more expansive about this record. Johnny Marr is using more keyboards. The arrangements with the help of Stephen Street, the producer, have really been fleshed out.
Yeah.
And Morrissey sounds somehow lighter, more melodic. It's a shame in a way that this was their final album. There's also a sense that the, you know, there's two songs that I think people who hate the Smiths or have this idea of the Smiths always pick on as being somehow representative of the Smiths and this miserabilism. Mm. One of them is Heaven Knows I'm Miserable Now.
Yeah.
And the other one is Girlfriend in a Coma, which is on this album. But they're completely missing, of course, the humour, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, they're both very funny in
the very funny ways. And deliberately so, yeah.
Well, this is not, I mean, you know, the Smiths did stretch out and obviously their B-sides were always exceptional, but they had, per each album, quite a uniform sound. Every album worked within quite a restricted set of parameters and obviously to great effect. And I like all of the albums they made. Probably the debut, although it does have a couple of my favourite ever Smiths pieces, that's the one which perhaps is the most samey, the one that I don't play as much.
The production
really
is quite rough on the album. It's quite hard to listen to, great songs.
Yes.
The Peel versions are better generally.
And the Hatful of Hollow that followed, which contained the Peel, some Peel sessions. Yeah, it just didn't seem to have a variety of tonality, that album. But yeah, everything they did, I adored. But this one, it was the band investigating everything. They were all over the place. And in this case, it worked. It actually still sounded coherent, partly because of the discipline of the songs, partly because of Morrissey's voice. It didn't to me seem particularly excessive or flabby. I think over the years, even more than The Queen Is Dead or Meet Us a Murder, it's the one that I come back to because of the variety of textures. And sometimes I think because of the strangeness of some of the arrangements and, you know, the sheer symphonic emotionalism of tracks like, you know, Last Night I Dreamt Somebody Loved Me, Death of a Disco Dancer, I think.
I think some of Morrissey's prettiest melodies, you know, I think of things like Stop Me if You Think You've Heard This One Before, I Won't Share You, Last Night I Dreamt Somebody Loved Me, just some beautifully memorable melodies and a slightly lighter sense. The music and the lyrics have a slightly lighter sense to them, more accessible. And maybe that's what some Smiths fans didn't like, because I think at the time it was seen as a bit of a step down from The Queen Is Dead. I love The Queen Is Dead, but I think, like you, I would probably be more likely to reach for this album and listen to it from beginning to end than I would any of the other Smiths, with the possible exception of the compilations, which I think in many ways are their best records. You know?
I mean, I think it's, as you've said, on one level it's lighter, but on another level it sort of challenges you, because, you know, Death of a Disco Dancer
That's
goes off into
song,
quite dissonant territory in a way the band never did. Yeah. And that has an aspect of Summer of Love Beatles. There's almost a psychedelic sensibility in the production at the end of that piece. I mean, and it ties in with this, as we were saying before, about 1987 representing a certain melancholy, a certain darkness. Death of a Disco Dancer taps into that and then ends almost in a kind of...
And Girlfriend in a Coma, obviously.
Yeah.
I mean, although it's a very light, fluffy pop song, lyrically it's pretty dark, obviously.
Yeah.
The other album from Manchester this year that I really love, and technically it's not really an album, it's a compilation, but for me this is their best record, which is New Order's Substance 1987, which is an album. It's a beautifully realised compilation. It's obviously a compilation that's had a lot of thought put into it, and it has a new song on it, True Faith, which is a great, great new song. It's a collection of all 12 of New Order's singles up until that moment in their extended 12-inch form. And I love it. I mean, Blue Monday for me is one of the greatest singles of all time. But there are so many great New Order singles during this period. Everything's Gone Green, you know, Confusion, Shell Shock. They're all here. And in a way that I don't necessarily enjoy the albums all the way through somehow, the actual official albums, with the possible exception of their first album, which I think we did discuss, didn't we?
Ceremony, isn't it?
Movement, yeah.
Oh, Movement.
Ceremony was the single from the This for me, feels like a really satisfying album.
Yes, I know what you mean. And yeah, I think we said before, The Movement is possibly our favourite New Order album. I mean, it's the logical follow-on from Joy Division's Closer. But I agree with you that in some ways, this is the most consistent album.
Mm.
It's all strong.
They were a great singles band in that
yes,
sense.
Yes, they were. Yeah, they were.
And then another Manchester, another favourite on our show, the Jurity Column, Vinnie Riley released his album, The Guitar and Other Machines, also produced by Stephen Street, who produced the Smiths album this year. Yeah. And I think for that reason, it's probably the most sonically, the most impressive album, the Jurity Column release. But yeah, it's far from my favourite.
I think it's a good rate. I think he betters it with the next Stephen Street
True.
Produced album,
yes, yes.
Vinnie Riley. And of course, the connection between the Smiths and Vinnie Riley then yields Vinnie Riley as the guitarist on Morrissey's debut solo album.
Indeed.
And he does an excellent job. It's a really good album, but it comes between, you know, what I think is a real highlight, Vinnie Riley. And I think, you know, you had Without Mercy not that long beforehand as well. I think that each of their albums had a very distinct identity. The problem with Guitar and Other Machines is it's a Jurity Column album.
Well, a bit of an error there, Tim. The previous album was Circus.
No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying it came slightly earlier.
Ah, you were saying it came between Without Mercy and Vinnie Riley, and it actually came
you
between.
You misunderstand.
Circus.
Without Mercy was pushed, and it was on Factory Records.
Yeah. Well, Circuses and Bread was released on Factory Benelux because Tony Wilson didn't want to release it on Factory in the
that's
UK.
Why.
Yeah, but that's not a reason. Bowie, quiet. So Bowie the dog's just come in. He wants to comment on Jurity Column. Actually, no, Bowie. What's the album before The Guitar and Other Machines? Is it Without Mercy?
Oh!
Or is it Circuses and Bread? What do you mean you don't know?
I think you're being pedantic.
Of course I'm being pedantic. What would you expect? Seriously, what do you expect?
I don't expect pedantry from
you. You don't expect me to be pedantic. On the Album Years podcast, you don't expect pedantry.
I don't expect pedantry.
Seriously? Right, let's quickly dispatch.
Yeah.
Not because these are not records that deserve to be talked about, but let's quickly dispatch Minimalism and ECM. The Chairman Dances, John Adams.
Yeah.
All Those Born With Wings, Jan Garbarek. Yeah. Akhenaten and Dance Pieces by Philip Glass. Do You Be by Meredith Monk. Arbos by Arvo Pärt. Cloud, Bowie, quiet. It's too late. We finished the Jurity Column discussion. Cloud About Mercury by David Torn. I'm going to guess you would like to talk about the Meredith Monk album.
Not necessarily. I owned...
Bowie wants to talk about it.
That's true. Do you think I'm wrong there? I owned most of those, and most of those I liked. I think Dance Pieces by Philip Glass, you know, the problem at this stage is there were a lot of Philip Glass recordings released. I wasn't quite as keen on his gargantuan operas.
I'm not a fan of opera anyway. I'm not a fan of the operatic style of singing. So Philip Glass doing what Philip Glass does with opera singers over the top is never going to be my preferred way to hear.
Well, also the orchestrations became mammoth during that time as well. The sound of his music changed. He was still making, that said, you know, intimate piano music, and he was still doing some great film soundtracks. And as I said, you know, out of those, never really liked Akhenaten, really liked Dance Pieces. Cloud About Mercury was a kind of interesting ECM release. Because David Torn, I suppose, is one of those artists on ECM who sort of slightly tore it apart. He's a slightly grittier, messier player. And he was using Bill Bruford and Tony Levin as his rhythm section.
What band were they in, Tim?
I'm not sure. It's a 1970s band.
Yeah. Drinks at the Ready Fund.
Queen?
It's coming up.
Wait a minute. They work with a really good guitarist. Wasn't Tony Iommi.
Okay.
Robert Fripp. King Crimson.
Okay, so, I mean, I'm surprised because I thought you were going to talk about Do You Be, because I know you're a big Meredith. I mean, remember?
Yeah, it's a good album, great cover. There isn't really that much to say about it. We discussed Meredith Monk on a previous show, and I can't kind of find any other words to describe what she does in some ways. You know, this was
somewhere between a weird kind of performance art, a performance artist.
And minimalism.
But it's all based around the voice, isn't it? That's the thing with Meredith.
Yes.
Everything is based around using the voice, but not using the voice to sing always. Sometimes using the voice in very percussive ways, in textural ways.
Yes.
She was all about exploring the possibilities of the voice in the context of kind of theatrical.
And weirdly enough, you could see how she might have crossed Jane Sibbery's radar with some of her rhythms and some of her vocal mannerisms. So that's another thing you can throw in to the Jane Sibbery mix, really.
And Arvo Pärt, this is the second album he's released on ECM. Amazing record, Arbos. I don't know what more we can say about Arvo Pärt. We've kind of covered him on the show before, haven't we?
Mm.
Let's The last two categories on the list, Tim, the future part one and the future part two. And I've named them these things because there is a sense of what is about to come and about to have a massive, massive influence on the whole path of music to come. The future part one is kind of the bands that anticipate grunge. And grunge is really, I think, the last... Somebody can always make an argument for this not being the case, but I think of grunge as the last big revolution in guitar music. Mm-hmm. As we sit here in 2023, the last big revolution in grunge music came at the dawn of the 90s. Nirvana, Soundgarden, Smashing Pumpkins. New metal came later. Britpop came later, I know. But I think for me, in terms of the way actually shaping not just music, but cinema, fashion, all of the things that rock music used to be able to do, have a big influence on lifestyle and all those things, grunge was really the last time that rock music felt like it had the power to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And in 1987, we have some real future echoes of grunge to come. And in fact, arguably, the band that really are responsible for grunge, Pixies.
Yeah.
Released their first, well, it was a mini album, Come On Pilgrim, on 4AD this year. And it's all there, isn't it? Everything we come to think of as grunge music is there in Pixies. The quiet, loud, quiet, mm-hmm. loud thing. I mean, surely that's a Pixies trademark, isn't it? And so in many ways, they don't get their credit. They don't get their due, do they?
No. I mean, I was about to say, because maybe there's something slightly quirkier about them. Obviously, they predate it. But then Smashing Pumpkins could be pretty quirky, and they managed in some ways to...
Black Francis wasn't as pretty as Kurt Cobain, was he? Let's face it.
That is true.
You know, and sometimes little things like that do matter, you know, in terms of being embraced by the pop.
I mean, I saw the Pixies on their first UK tour, and they were phenomenal live. And I'd gone there to see Throwing Muses, and Throwing Muses were good. And Throwing Muses at that time, you know, had a slightly more kind of arty, almost indie, Talking Heads poetic quality. But I got to say, the Pixies would have blown anyone out of the water. You know, I've never been necessarily a great fan of the albums they've made. I think they're good and I like some of them. And weirdly, I quite like Trompe Le Monde, which is the one people didn't like. But they were staggeringly good live.
I think they are a band that have cast such a shadow over rock music in the same way that perhaps bands like Velvet Underground and Can have been so influential without ever necessarily being massively commercially successful themselves.
Mm.
Pixies would be one of those bands. They're almost like a musician's musician.
And they had an immediate impact, really, because if you think of, you know, we're talking here the musician's musician. David Bowie was one of the people who discovered Velvet Underground, or at least he was given some Velvet Underground material and started to champion them in the press and his own music. And actually, he was one of the people who championed the Pixies and, of course, formed Tin Machine partly, I think, as a result of that.
I believe that's true, Also, this year we have Dinosaur Jr., You're Living All Over Me, Sonic Youth's Sister, fantastic record. I mean, Sonic Youth always had a more garagey New York kind of aesthetic to them, but definitely they were part of the fabric of what grunge mm-hmm. became. Big Black, Songs About Fucking, an early Steve Albini project. Steve Albini would become one of the key figures in grunge music, producing In Utero for Nirvana, but also albums later for people like PJ Harvey.
Husker Du, would they fit into that or not?
Husker Du would. I don't know if they made an album this year, but they definitely, Bob Mould and Husker Du would fit into that too, And the second part of the future is... Wow, we got two albums released this year that you probably would have to say on all of the albums on this list have had the longest significant impact on
Rick Astley?
Not Rick Astley. I think this is game over in terms of what's the most long-term influential records. Public Enemy.
Yeah.
Yo Bum Rush the Show and Paid in Full by Eric B and Rakim. Hip Hop Records. And wow, what an impact hip-hop has had and continues to have on contemporary pop music. And here we have, I mean, you know, obviously hip-hop has been twisted into lots of different shapes, more commercial, less commercial. This is really the beginnings of hip-hop as we know it.
Mm-hmm.
Are you a fan, Tim?
Public Enemy, yeah.
The first hip-hop, you know, the first Public Enemy record, and arguably Public Enemy, the most important of all the early hip-hop bands.
Yeah, I mean, obviously I'm thinking back to obviously 70s things like Last Poets that get credited as being kind of birth Gil Scott-Heron and so on.
But they're not hip-hop bands. I mean, we're talking early...
Grandmaster Flash, you know.
Yeah, which is sort of commonly seen as the first sort of rap crossover, rap single.
Yeah.
But here's hip-hop pretty much as we know it today. This is the debut Public Enemy record. And it's interesting because these records are happening very much at an underground level at the time, aren't they?
They're still getting published. I mean, I remember The Enemy were picking up on a lot of this, and Melody Maker did as well. So it was interesting seeing them in this era of goth, in this era of Smiths. Public Enemy are still one of my favourite bands in the genre, partly because they're almost like the Black Sabbath. They're a blueprint for a certain type of music, but there's something really nasty and dirty and hard-hitting about their music as well.
But it's
I suppose ties in with the Swans.
Absolutely,
as well.
Absolutely, yeah. But I mean, it's very literate as well, isn't it? I mean, okay, there's a fair amount of, you know, politically incorrect lyrics in here. But it's very smart. It's very canny. It's very wordy. It's very, you know, in some ways, it's very intellectual. Yeah. And there's a lot to talk about here.
No, I can already hear that Open University program on it. You know, it's a bit like with Dylan, because I think they kind of did have in that culture almost that kind of impact of a Dylan, as Dylan's being the poet of the generation and so
very
on.
Much so. I mean, this album wasn't particularly successful at the time. I'm looking at the Wikipedia page now. It got to number 125 on the US Billboard 200. And that's the only place it charted in the world, apparently. And yet it reverberates, doesn't it, through the years. I mean, 36 years ago this album came out. Mm. And it's still, I would say, pretty much seen as year zero for what we think of as modern contemporary hip-hop music.
Mm-hmm.
There's a sense that things haven't moved. Obviously, they have moved on, but there are certain elements of what Public Enemy were doing in 1987 that are still central to what hip-hop music is to this day, and one that almost flew under the radar at the time.
I think, I think there were debates, especially in the British music press, and I think The Enemy, certainly some of their journalists championed.
You're absolutely right. It was named as the best album of 1987 I stand corrected. Yeah, so Enemy pretty quick onto the bandwagon, named it as the best album of 1987. Now, I'm guessing that probably for most of the previous 10 years, it would have been things like the Smiths and the Cocteau Twins getting the best album of the year in The Enemy. So this is a very,
very
big shift, isn't it, towards hip-hop culture. So this is a big moment, isn't it, 1987?
I think it was, and I think that it caused some dissent amongst the journalists. And obviously, by the early 90s, there was a different kind of momentum creatively after grunge, Britpop. And Enemy, in a sense, lived and died on Britpop in the end, because it became so associated with that culture that by the early 2000s, it partly technology, partly people getting out of the habit of buying, partly demographics, but it suddenly seemed out of sorts with anything that was happening and not able to catch up.
So there we go, 1987. Fascinating year, really. As I say, these future echoes for grunge and hip-hop particularly seem in some ways to be the most significant developments in the year. But there was a lot of interesting things going on, as we've discussed, you know, in goth, in electronic music, singer-songwriter. What would be your pick of the year, Tim, if you could pick an album? I think the influential category is already taken care of, unless you disagree with me.
I think Public Enemy has to be the influential
album
of choice. And in terms of personal album of choice, couldn't be further away from the Public Enemy, but probably Secrets of the Beehive.
Okay. I'm just looking at the list now. I think Slab's album, Dissension, is a very big record for me. I might go with that one. I'm seeing if there's anything that's going to challenge it here. I love the Smiths record, Strange Ways.
Yeah, I mean, Strange Ways is pretty close. I know that this is not a rated Smiths album, but, you know, it's in my top three of this year, possibly.
And I also love two sprawling double albums from this year, the Prince album and the Cure album.
Ah, that's one album we didn't really properly discuss, because I always think that Kiss Me, Kiss Me, Kiss Me is their physical graffiti in terms of the ground it covers. And not only does it have Why Can't I Be You, that vibrant, joyous single, It also has some of their doomiest ballads, some gorgeous pieces of music on this record. So I've always liked it. As a Cure album and as a sprawling double, I think it works quite well.
I love it. I much prefer it to Disintegration, which is obviously a much higher rated record. Disintegration is very kind of samey to me all the way through.
I think Disintegration suffers primarily because it's a CD age album. If Disintegration were 40 minutes long, it's up there with Faith, 17 Seconds, Pornography.
See, I don't think it would be for me, even in that case, because there's something about the late 80s production that rubs me slightly up the wrong way with Disintegration. I love that kind of parched, dry, claustrophobic sound of Faith, Pornography, 17 Seconds. Disintegration has this big stadium rock production.
Yeah.
I'm not that fond of it. Kiss Me, Kiss Me, Kiss Me, on the other hand, I love it. And as you kind of pointed out, it's very diverse, very eclectic. Mm. It's very playful in places, but it's also got some quite nihilistic moments as well. Yes. The title track, you know, The Kiss, that opens the record. You know, it's a very brave way to open a record, I think. 7 minutes sort of like squall of guitar noise.
Yeah. A few of their albums were kind of flirting with the extremities of goth noise, playful pop, and these kind of nihilistic ballads. You know, Head on the Door to an extent, and obviously the kind of the top Love Cats era had that, but I think this was the most successful distillation of almost every Cure identity,
and a couple of new ones too.
I really like, I mean, I liked it a lot at the time, really like it now.
Yeah, great lyrics as well, that song. Mm. How Beautiful You Are. It's pretty dark, yeah. And also Just Like Heaven is one of their most famous songs, is on this record. It's a great single, yeah. So I'm going to go for a couple of sprawling... I'm going to be a cheat here and pick three or four. A couple of sprawling doubles, Kiss Me, Kiss Me, Kiss Me by The Cure, Sign of the Times by Prince, The Slab record, and what was the other one I picked a minute ago, which I've now... The Smiths record, yeah. Great, okay. Well, that's 1987 wrapped up. We will be back with something else another year at some point. We haven't decided what we're going to do next. Maybe we should do something else from the 2000s, Tim. We did try one, didn't we?
We've tried at least one, yeah.
Yeah, but we haven't revisited the 21st century. Maybe we should do that.
It's quite scary.
Well, it's a bit scary. I think it's a bit scarier because obviously in the 21st century sees a kind of proliferation of music generally. There's more music being made than in the 20th century. But also there's less of it that we're kind of familiar with, I suppose, whereas with a couple of exceptions, we kind of are listening to everything in 1987.
Yeah.
And we get to the 21st century and there's a lot of music I just don't have any interest in and I don't listen to and I couldn't tell you anything about. But let's maybe try as an experiment and see what happens.
Let's go for it. Well, we could even suggest that people suggest a year to us.
That might be a good idea. Let's get... pick a year and see what people, you know, see what other people say they were listening to in that year.
Yeah.
And then we can go and listen to it. Thank you very much for listening. As always, if you've enjoyed this podcast, please leave us a good review or don't, whatever you want. And we'll see you again soon. But for now, goodbye from me and goodbye from Tim.
Bye-bye.